Ladies and gentlemen, our town is starting its second century. This is a time when any happening anywhere in the world can have vital, fatal consequences in our lives. Often we'd like to forget that, but we do so only at our peril. The biggest headlines in our papers concern foreign affairs. The most important business of our government is its relations with foreign countries. It's the fact of the aeroplane and the splitting of the atom and the resulting H-bomb that make it so. The number one question in the world today is whether or not we can solve the conflict between the Soviet Union and ourselves without a war. The great historian Arnold Toynbee says the problem is the same today as it was in Lincoln's time. Can mankind endure half slave and half free? Then, Toynbee says, it was a problem of the United States. Today, it is a problem of the world. We have invited to be met a series of distinguished speakers. What is said here today and on the following Sundays will be heard all around the world, even behind the Iron Curtain, by radio. The town meetings of BMED are, as our Senator Douglas said, an adventure in faith. Our guest today is a man who has been chairman of the most important committee in the United States Senate, the Foreign Relations Committee. He is now its ranking Republican member. No senator has studied the problems of the world more thoroughly than our guest. No senator has been more loyal or more helpful to the President of the United States in supporting his policies than our guest today. In many countries of the world where I've been, and in the Senate, he is known as a man of goodwill. Today he has come, a great personal sacrifice to himself, to share his thoughts with us. And he has agreed at the end to answer any questions that you may have. Ladies and gentlemen, the senior senator from Wisconsin, the Honorable Alexander Wiley.
Thank you, my good friend. I come to this hallowed spot, as Lincoln might call it, not tired, but refreshed. I have met friends, and I have been treated as a friend. I've gone to the home where Lincoln and Douglas chatted, as we will chat today. I've seen the spot where Douglas helped pull Lincoln out of the mud, and I said, it's good to know that even great men have to be pulled out of the mud once in a while. Well, it's a privilege to be here at this town meeting. The tradition of the Lincoln-Douglas debate is one of historic, great historic significance, historical hallmark of American political life. No series of political exchanges have marked themselves so indelibly in the memory of the American people as the Douglas or the Lincoln-Douglas debate. Here was a great period in American history, a challenging period, a stormy period. Here were two masterful figures in American life, notably the man who was to become the great emancipator and Douglas, the little giant. And here was a great issue. They weren't debating personalities or throwing mud. They were debating issues, being debated in the American manner with sincerity, with openness, with candor, before the bar of public opinion. We could learn from that. We can learn from that statement that you have back here of Lincoln, with malice toward none. I wish we could in our daily lives and in our political attempt for solutions forget the petty and the small, and reach out, as these two did, to solve the issue, and not indulge in personalities. Abe Lincoln didn't go, after that debate, to the Senate. But he did later go to the White House, and he did become enshrined in mankind's heart. Now, my friend, Lincoln's life to me has been an inspiration. I want to tell you briefly why. What I have to say is not in my manuscript, but out of his life have come to me three pearls of great price. One, and how wonderful it is. If someone had told me when I was a young man what I am telling you now, it might have saved me lots of heartache, lots of worry, and even physical sickness. Because to a large extent, the way we think and fear many times has a direct physical reaction upon us. Lincoln had three pearls of great price. First, as I told the gentleman at lunch today, he was a master of the utilization of humor. He used it up and down the very places we're in today. When he was a lawyer, he used it when he was in Washington, when across the river the rebels were in sight of the White House. And he would get to his cabinet meetings, and there he would find his cabinet officers filled with fear and doubt and worry. And they were no good to him or his country under that condition. He'd tell a funny story. I won't exemplify it because I must go on with my speech. The second pearl was prayer. Lincoln said, when I have no other place to go, I go to my knees. And I might tell you that your president, Eisenhower, opens up every cabinet meeting with silent prayer. Why? Just as in England, in Lincoln's time, he sensed that he of himself was not adequate. So men today seeking to face these problems that Mr. Smith has spoken to you about, sense they need the guidance of the Almighty. They need the confidence that comes from reaching for a higher wisdom than their own. That was the second pearl of great price, the utilization of prayer. The third pearl of great price was a selfless devotion to a great cause. Lincoln selflessly, not selfishly, devoted himself to preserve the Union, so much so when the greatest newspaper man of his time, Horace Greeley, said, "Let the South go," Lincoln said no. Now I just ask you where Lincoln got that wisdom. He didn't have book learning. He didn't have any master's or doctor's degree. He had been a student of the Bible. He had learned on bended knee. Now I say that if he had followed the advice of the wiseacres of his time, we'd have been another Europe, split up into 48 conflicting countries. Where did Lincoln get his wisdom? Well, just where every man and woman who needs wisdom and knows that it's available if he'll reach for it, just where they get it. Lincoln said, when I have no other place to go, I go to my knees. And he used to pray in his cabinet meetings. Those are the three pearls of great price. Wonderful pearls. The more you give of them, the more you have. They shine brighter in your own lives, and Lincoln found that out. Today I address myself to the vital question suggested by the chairman here. Can mankind endure half slave and half free? I believe the answer to that question is yes, with certain qualifications. Yes, if we are vigilant. Yes, if we are strong. The answer is yes, if we definitely do not. I repeat, if we do not give moral sanction, moral approval to communist slavery simply because it is entrenched, even though we reject war as a means of abolishing that slavery. The answer is yes. In summary, if we remain true to our own ideals, to Lincoln's ideals, he wanted to save the Union. We want to save this country. We want to save it with strength, but not with war. As you can see, as is the case of most important questions, we must bear in mind a great many factors in the world today, a great many necessary reservations also. In the first place, let it be stated emphatically that the United States rejects the institution of human slavery today, just as we rejected it almost a century ago on the field of battle, even when brother had to fight brother on this continent in four bloody years of war. Ours is a moral people. We live by the moral law. We know that slavery, whether it be the slavery based on the color of man's skin or the class slavery imposed by a communist dictatorship, utterly outrages the conscience of mankind. We will never be silent in the face of slavery. Lincoln pointed out in the course of his great career that to be silent in the face of evil is to take part in that evil. We cannot be silent, therefore, before the slavery of Eastern Europe. We cannot, must not, ignore the suffering of the Russian people themselves, who since November 1917 have been shackled under the cruelest despotism in the history of the world. We cannot ignore the plight of 550 million people of China, mercilessly tyrannized by the despotic clique of Peking. We cannot ignore the plight of the suffering people of North Korea, nor that of the unfortunate population of communist-controlled northern Vietnam. Wherever there is slavery, that is where the conscience of America asks for freedom. At once the North could not ignore the moans and suffering of the enslaved Negroes of the South, so today the people of the free world hears the moans and groans from the concentration camps of Siberia, the forced labor camps everywhere behind the Iron Curtain. We can see in our mind's eye the persecution, the suffering, the torment of the enslaved hundreds of millions. We will never acquiesce to their permanent enslavement. As a matter of fact, we oppose slavery in every shape. Get that. Slavery in every shape, manner or form, political, economic, intellectual, or any other. We oppose the principles of colonialism. We ourselves emerged to independence through the fortitude of 13 colonies, which appeal to the conscience of mankind in our own Declaration of Independence. Now the second factor, my friend, to keep in mind is that all the history is full of instances where opposing systems did exist side by side in the relative peace. It may have been an uneasy peace, a peace occasionally broken, but it was peace nevertheless. Opposing religions learned to live together alongside one another, even though a few centuries ago, two of the great religions of Western civilization were relentlessly engaged in the bitterest type of national and civil wars. Men of these two great faiths literally burned each other at the stake in the mistaken notion that they were doing God's will. And today, the great Christian faiths have learned to live in peace with one another and in harmony, and in so living, they have learned religion. Before, they didn't have it. So, too, history is full of the record of rival economic systems which contested with one another, and which nevertheless managed to live in a relative state of peace. As was mentioned by the chairman, the great historian Arnold Toynbee has constantly re-emphasized and documented this point, that opposing systems have learned to live with one another, whether it be Christianity with Islam, or feudalism with capitalism, or republicanism with monarchy. Why, we Republicans can even live with the Democrats, you know that. If contrasting systems can coexist and have coexisted, wherein arises the current problem? Now that's the issue. If they have existed, where is the problem? It arises from the third factor, my friends. The factor is, of course, the aggressive imperialistic nature of international communism. The current situation exists not because we want to conquer the world. On the contrary, we desire that all men shall freely work out their own destiny in their own way. We hope that they will work it out in a manner of freedom. We hope they will recognize the light of limited power, of separation of powers, which has come from this republic and from other beacons of freedom. We are proud of our way, but we do not want to impose our way on others. We know that mankind is stratified today with parts of the human race at different levels economically, socially, politically, culturally, religiously, and otherwise. We do not want to make the world over in America's image, though we believe it would be good for the world if they could make themselves over in our image. But the Kremlin does want to make the world over in the Kremlin's image. It is the Kremlin which for 37 years in callous violation of its pledges, has been engaged in above the ground and under the ground conspiracy. It is the Kremlin which has constructed the most diabolic Trojan horse movement in history, using internal armies of saboteurs, seditionists, traitors, and others to destroy this nation from within. It is the Kremlin which insists, in accordance with the Marxist dogma, that the world must be all communist, or else, quote, the capitalists will take it over. Now I want you to listen to these questions, to these quotations, my friend. Quote, the existence of the Soviet Republic side by side with imperialist states for a long time is unthinkable. One or the other must triumph in the end. And before that end supervenes, a series of frightful collisions between the Soviet Republic and the bourgeois states will be inevitable. As long as capitalism and socialism exist, we cannot live in peace. In the end, one or the other will triumph. A funeral dirge will be sung over the Soviet Republic or over the world capitalism.